of these things about baptism. So I have a couple. Now, I don't have any prizes tonight, but aww. Yeah, that's okay. That's okay, I got to figure it out. What you do is you go right down here to Quick Check and you get yourself a prize. All right, yeah. They got king-size candy bars. You'll be fine. So if you get this right, so I'm going to actually, I know the question, so I'm going to have Mr. Robert stay where he's at tonight because I think I can handle these. Question one, and you got to raise your hand if you know the answer. Have we ever had the baptism anywhere else than at the Cooper's house? Have we ever had the baptism anywhere? It's really hard to find those hands ago, Mr. Robert. I should have had you over here. I think Joe Hathaway was the first. Have we ever held the baptism anywhere else than the Cooper's house?
No, never.
We never have. We've never had. The Coopers have been so gracious. I would recommend the king-size white Kit Kat. Okay, that's good. All right, well, help you out a little bit. No, we've never had it anywhere. The Coopers have been so gracious as to let us invade their home and just have an incredible time at the baptism. So that's where we're headed back to. Until they tell us, you're out. We're going to stay right there, okay? How about this one? Has the baptism ever been held in any other month than July and August? Oh, I thought I saw a hand go up. Miss Sarah, what?
July and August?
Yeah, has it ever been outside of July or August?
No.
She says, no, it hasn't.
Oh, September.
Oh, Miss Tara was baptized last year, September. Good try, though. It was a good try, though. Good job. Excellent. We've always had it in July and August, but last year we changed it because we just knew God wanted us to move it. We did, and it was awesome, wasn't it? Last chance. So I would still encourage you to get a candy bar, though.
You
can only
have a small one, though.
Yeah, you can get a small one. You don't got to worry about Miss Sarah. She does the right thing. Yeah, she's good. How about this one? This is good. It's been a lot of years. A lot of years of baptism. Has it ever rained during the baptism? Oh! I thought I saw Caleb D's hand first. Has it ever rained
on mine.
It rained on yours. I know. It was a sign.
Oh, Lord!
Maybe I should answer it this way. Have we ever canceled for rain?
No.
Nope. We just go right ahead. Our people don't care if it's pouring rain. They just dance around in the rain. I don't know. It's like the hippies in the 60s. They didn't care. Our people have a good time anyway. So the baptism's coming. Looking forward to it. Please, if you have engaged Jesus Christ in your heart and accepted his offer of salvation, then it's time. It's time to tell the world, and I'll walk you through it. We'll work together, and it'll be a lot of fun, and like I said, it'll be incredible. And the whole thing is really a picture. What God designed was a picture, that you standing there, I had my old life, and I want my old life washed away under the water, and it's washed away, and I go down under the water, and my old life is washed away, and I come up to a new life that Jesus Christ is at the helm of, that Jesus Christ is at the steering wheel of. If you have not done that, that it's a powerful thing that God asks us to do. It doesn't save you, but it is something that is powerful in your life and it's very powerful for others. So I encourage you to be a part of that. Talk to me afterwards if you're unsure. We'll walk you right through the whole process. All right, here we go. Revelation chapter 11. So open up your iPhones, your iPads, phones, Bibles, everything you have to Revelation chapter 11. This is a biggie tonight. We got some major, major stuff going on here. Not that the other stuff wasn't, but here we go. When we left our study last time, God had kind of taken a break from unleashing the seven trumpet judgments, right? He took a break from that. He held up on number seven. He said, whoop, put the brakes on before I get to number seven. And what God did was he spent the entire chapter 10, ministering to John the Apostle's heart and ministering to John the Apostle's soul to strengthen him. Because it's tough. What he's doing is tough. It's tough for us to hear it. He had to endure seeing it all and recording it. Well, as we head into chapter 11, God is still in this parenthesis period, the parenthetical period, where he's taking a break and he used from the trumpet judgments as far as unleashing them. And God actually takes this time to kind of pause and zoom in. He wants to zoom in on certain aspects of what is happening during these trumpet judgments. And he zooms in tonight on a certain place and some very prominent issues. God is going to zoom in on the nation of Israel. Most notably, he's going to zoom in on Jerusalem. And he's going to show this to John before he unleashes the seventh trumpet. He's going to show this to John and show him what's going on in Israel, in Jerusalem, at this time, when the sixth trumpet has been sounded. And we've been through all of the seals, the seven seals. Now we've been through six of the trumpet judgments. And here we go. Revelation 11, chapter 11, verse 1. John writes this. He says, "Then I was given a measuring stick, and I was told, go and measure the temple of God and the altar and count the number of worshipers. But do not measure the outer courtyard, for it has been turned over to the nations, but they will trample the holy city for 42 months, or 3.5 years. Okay, I want to stop there. We have to stop right there because something very important has just happened. A big, big piece of information has been unleashed upon John and upon us. John is shown Jerusalem, but most notably, John is shown the temple in Jerusalem. So much so he's told to go measure. God is making a big deal that this temple is in Jerusalem. Now, gang, here's the deal. The fact that there is a temple there is a huge, huge deal. The reason is because there is no Jewish temple there today. It's not there. All that is left of the two previous Jewish temples that were there, all that is left is a piece of the retaining walls that were around it. A piece of it is left there, and that retaining wall, that wailing wall as they call it, that is the most holy place the Jewish people have to this day. But God, here in Revelation 11, shows John in Jerusalem that there is a Jewish temple there. Now, there is tons of speculation and argument about what is this new temple? It's in Jerusalem, there it is, and even more confusion about how is this thing built? When is it built? I want to give you a brief history of what's going on here, why the temple is such a big deal. In the beginning of the Old Testament, we go back to the Old Testament, God never had a house. God never had a house. He never had a temple. He never had a building. He never had an earthly home. God never had a church building. He never had a synagogue. He never had a permanent address in the beginning of the Old Testament. So what God did in the time of Moses, God has Israel fashion what he's going to call the tabernacle. God told Moses to commission the building of a very large rectangular tent-like structure. Now, this tent-like structure could be torn down, and it could be transported anywhere Israel went, and they could set it up anywhere. This tabernacle, this tent building with walls around it of fabric as well, it served as God's house. Basically, it was a lot of poles and a lot of hanging fabric, and that was God's house. It was called the tabernacle. But when King David comes on the scene, the man after God's own heart, he wants to do something special for God. David desires to build God a beautiful, permanent building. Is this going to be God's temple? God likes this gesture. God thinks this is nice. And he says, David, I like that. Just one thing. You're not the guy who's supposed to build it. Your son, Solomon, he's the one who is supposed to build it. And so, God gives these very detailed instructions on where his temple should be placed in Jerusalem on a mount. He tells them where it should be placed, and David's son, Solomon, does all that God tells him to do. He builds that first temple for Israel, and it's incredible. It's referred to as Solomon's temple. Solomon built it, and it was placed exactly where God said it was to be, in Jerusalem. And it was the key central gathering point, and it was the key pilgrimage place of all the worshipers of Israel. Solomon's temple lasted for 400 years. Then it was destroyed by the Babylonians. Ugh, it was there. And they destroyed it, tore it to nothing. It's okay. 70 years later, after that, the book of Ezra tells us that they go to build the temple a second time. A second temple is built. This second temple, this is the one Jesus walked in. This is the one that Jesus taught in, this second temple. This second temple was built around 370 years before Jesus was born, and it was even expanded. It was expanded and made nicer by King Herod, of all people. This temple, because of Herod's extra work done to it, is known as Herod's Temple. It's the second Jewish temple. It's Herod's Temple. It was called Herod's Temple. He didn't own it. The Jews for the Jews. And this second temple was, again, the key gathering point and the key pilgrimage place for worship of all the Israelites. All seems good, right? We're in good shape. Second temple's up, running. Jesus is there. Jesus talks in the temple. Jesus has been to the temple. Well, guess what? That temple was destroyed in 70 AD, about 35 years after Jesus was in it. That temple was destroyed. And Westbridge, since that day, 2,000 years ago, since that day, that temple has not been rebuilt. There has been no Jewish temple there. And to complicate matters even worse, here's what makes it even harder now. The Temple Mount, the exact location where the temple is supposed to be, there's a mosque on it. There's a Muslim mosque. It's built right there where the temple is supposed to be, and the Jewish people cannot build their temple there, even if they wanted to, because they don't own the property. It belongs to others than Israel. That's the history. So, back to Revelation 11. So how and why is there a third temple? And this thing is important. It's playing a key role. It's a key location in the end times. And it's very important. The obvious question we all ask is, should we be expecting a new temple, a new Jewish temple, to be built before the end times begin? Should we be waiting for that? Is that kind of a trigger for us? Well, the answer is, we're not sure. We're not sure. Why? Well, because it's possible that the end times could begin before a new temple can be built, but that during the first portion of the end times, the way things build today, that could be built then, especially this Antichrist who promises peace with Israel during the first 3 years. That's possible. We're not sure what the timeline is, gang. But it is something. This is something that people are carefully watching out for. Now, back to our Bible study and back to John's look at Israel. The voice from heaven, which we believe is God, the voice from heaven says this. Verse 3 of 11. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will be clothed in burlap, and they will prophesy during those 1260 days, 3.5 years again. These two prophets are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of all the earth. If anyone tries to harm them, these two prophets, if anyone tries to harm them, fire flashes from their mouths and consumes their enemies. This is how anyone who tries to harm them must die. They have power to shut the sky so that no rain will fall for as long as they prophesy. And they have the power to turn the rivers and oceans into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they wish. And when they complete their testimony, the beast that comes up out of the bottomless pit will declare war against them. And the beast will conquer them, and he will kill them. And these two witnesses' bodies will lie in the main street of Jerusalem, the city that is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, the city where the Lord was crucified. And for 3.5 days, all peoples, all tribes, nations, and languages will stare at the two witnesses' dead bodies. no one will be allowed to bury them. All the people who belong to this world will gloat over them, and they will give presents to each other to celebrate the death of the two prophets who had tormented them. But after 3.5 days, God breathed life into them, and they stood up. Terror struck all who stared at them. Then a loud voice from heaven called to the two prophets, "Come up here." And they rose to heaven in a cloud as their enemies watched. Wow. Let's unpack this. First, we have two powerful prophets brought onto the scene by God. Second, we see a great dragon responsible for slaughtering these two prophets. Let's handle the two prophets first. Who are they? Who are these two prophets? Well, they are prophets that seem to be more powerful than any prophets have ever been seen before. What does the Bible tell us? Simply going on what the Bible tells us, they are given power to preach for 3.5 years. That's the first half of the 7-year tribulation. Remember, most of this tribulation is what most of Revelation is dealing with, this 7-year period of tribulation. These two prophets are able to preach out loud for 3.5 years. Also, they have miraculous powers that enable them to protect themselves from their enemies. We're also told that after their witnessing is over for 3.5 years, God allows them to be murdered. And their dead bodies are seen by the entire world. 3.5 days later, they will rise from the dead. And they will be lifted up. It's very specific here. They will be lifted up into the air to go up to heaven. Who are they? Who are these two guys? The answer? We are not told. We are not told who they are. Now, if you want to do bad Bible study, just start guessing. Just start guessing and name them anybody you want. That's a Moses and that's Elijah, right? Weren't they at the Transfiguration? You're guessing, buddy. How about this? Peter and Paul. Not Mary, just Peter and Paul. Oh, you have to be over 40 to get that. Right? We don't know who they are. How about this one? This is one of the best ones I thought. This is a really good guess. Enoch and Elijah. Why do you think someone would think they're Enoch and Elijah?
Because they were carried up into heaven, they never died.
Those two people never died. Elijah was taken up in a fiery chariot, and Enoch, it said, just went to be with the Lord. He didn't die, right? So those are good guesses. What does Revelation 11 tell us? Nothing. You don't get to know, gang. Like I said, it would be poor Bible study to do that. We don't do that here. Good Bible study says we're not told who they are. So let's take what God gives us. Let's accept that these are two special envoys from God to do this job of winning people over to God. And as this whole scene takes place in Israel, it's believed that these are two prophets sent specifically to Israel to save the Israelites. God is not done with Israel. We tend to think the church is now Israel. If you look at it, it seems that Israel never disappears. They're still prominent. You think after all these centuries, that little piece of dirt over there wouldn't be important. It's still the hotbed of everything, isn't it? That's what we got for the prophets. How about the dragon, the one who kills them? Well, that's a lot easier. We believe John to be referring here to the Antichrist. There's lots of things in here that makes us believe this great dragon. He's really talking about the Antichrist, who again, he's ruling in these 7 years. He sets up a time of peace, and then he's gonna wham, put the whammy on, and it's gonna be bad. We believe he is the one that ushers in the idea of killing the two prophets. So, these two prophets appear, they herald the gospel for 3.5 years, they can't be hurt by anyone, and they have power over rain, they have power over the drought. They are effective. We know they are effective in their gospel pronouncement. But then God allows the Antichrist to slay them. It's amazing. In scenes very much like we see on TV today or on our phones with people's bodies being left in the streets over there. Remember Gaddafi when he was killed and the video footage of that? They're left in the streets to be ridiculed. These prophets, these beaten, rotting prophets' corpses are there for 3.5 days. And it says the whole world, the entire world sees it. They watch it. Then they are miraculously, after 3.5 days, these two just stand up. They're resurrected right in front of the eyes of the world because everybody's watching. This is an amazing passage. This is an amazing passage. Unfortunately, it leaves us with more questions than answers. But what I'd like to do is draw your attention to the truths that are inside this passage. This is on your outline. Truth number one. God has the power of life and death. Now, you might say, that seems like something that we've been taught a million times. But I believe, gang, that it's something that we tend to forget. These two prophets walk the earth, and they can't be touched. They boldly talk about God while the Antichrist seethes. But God protects them. Eventually, God allows them to be martyred and made public spectacles, only to have them stand up, brush themselves off, and rise into heaven to be with Jesus. You know, this reminds me a lot of Jesus with his enemies. When Jesus' enemies wanted to grab him, remember he was preaching, they said they went to him to kill him, and we're told that Jesus walked right through their midst without being touched, leading us to believe that probably they couldn't see him. Nothing is going to happen that God does not allow to happen. And that's what we're talking about here. God has a timeline, and God has a plan. And nothing is going to change God's timeline, and nothing is going to change God's plan. These days, my friends, there are a lot of God followers, especially here in the United States, who are very fearful. They're fearful because biblical guidelines that our country was founded on, and biblical guidelines that we've experienced God's blessing in, these are now being wiped away. Sins that the Bible clearly orders us to stay away from and to spurn, well, those things are now being labeled as good. And we are told to encourage those things and reward those things. That's an important time, friends, when we need to remember what we see here in these two prophets. Truth number two. God's got your back. God's got your back, man. I learned this lesson years ago when we started out by renting the Stuartsville Middle School. We started out there many years ago. We were going along swimmingly in the Stuartsville Middle School. People were finding life in Jesus Christ, and the whole thing was just great. Then from out of nowhere, we were told that there was a very forceful woman who had been very loud with her mouth to the school board members. Apparently, this woman didn't like Westbridge renting that school, and she went on a crusade to get us out. I never met her, I never saw her, I don't even know who she is, but I was told this is what happened. Well, before long, we received a letter in the mail telling us that our rent that we pay for just Saturday night was going to be tripled, and that our custodian fee was going to be raised as well. But like I said, this is a lot of years ago. Westbridge could not afford it. And I was floored. What? Why? Why do wicked people prosper, God? Don't you want this ministry to continue? Come on! Aren't we supposed to be protected by you from this kind of stuff? From some loudmouth? Why are we being slaughtered We're the good ones. Well, friends, the darkness of this world hates the light. It hates it. If you've got the light of Jesus Christ in you, the world's going to hate you. Therefore, we will all come across opposition. When we try to advance God's kingdom, we've seen it here in our midst. Your employment may be made vulnerable because you love Jesus. Your housing may be put at risk because you are a follower of God. Your family members may threaten to turn against you because you are a disciple of Jesus. Well, what these two witnesses here in Revelation 11 show us is that God has our back. God will get his work done. Whether the opposition follows through or not, God will get his will and his way done. Westbridge, by the way, did have those higher rents forced on us. They were. But God brought us a new school before we ever made one dime of payment to those higher rents. God got us a new school to rent. And the new school was even more affordable than we were paying before they raised the rents. We never missed a service. We never skipped a beat proclaiming God's love. And since then, I personally have never worried about keeping Westbridge running. I don't worry about that. God has our back, and he will allow us to minister as long as he sees fit. Friends, when you are doing what God has shown you to do, and that's important, when you're doing what God has shown you to do, and when you're being obedient to what the Bible tells you to do, you don't need to have concern. God has a will, and he has a plan, and you are in that plan, and he will protect your back. The next truth that we see here, truth number three, is this. Defeat is often the springboard to victory. God has his witnesses preach and proclaim for 3.5 years. But then God allows these witnesses to be killed and ridiculed, didn't he? That defeat in our eyes lasts for 3 days. And then unbelievably, those two prophets stand up, brush themselves off for the entire world to see, and are supernaturally taken up into the air into heaven. Now, there's no doubt that their 3.5 year message and that this event that people are watching has significant impact on everyone. Look what the verse says, verse 13. At the same time as this happening, there was a terrible earthquake that destroyed a tenth of the city. 7,000 people died in that earthquake, and everyone else was terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. These two prophets, like a phoenix, they rise from the ashes, from that filthy, dirty street, dusty, rotted corpses, like phoenixes, they rise. They triumph from tragedy. Gang, the Bible is filled with stories of people rising from the ashes of defeat and miracles coming from the pit of despair. It's like a springboard at a swimming pool. It would appear the further down you go on the springboard, the more intense and high you go on the upswing. Friends, most people are getting pretty good at dealing with the upside. We like the upside. We like the victory side. You hope like crazy that these people will stay strong in the struggle, that they will not give up, that they will not accept defeat, but that they will eventually springboard out of that pit of despair. The majority of their story, as we watch it, is more about who they are in tough times, isn't it? The majority of their story is more about how they will handle the problems that come at them. The majority of their story is really more about how they handle discouragements and defeats. Well, life with God promises to have our downswing of the diving board as well, my friends. The focus for us is in keeping the faith no matter what we feel like, keeping the faith no matter what the circumstances around us look like. I find a great deal of strength in the words of Job when his world seemed stuck in an unexplainable downswing. Job's response when he was in defeat, when he was in loss, when he was in confusion, when he was in pain, was this: though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Job's resolve is contagious. He doesn't question God. He doesn't judge whether or not God is good or God is right. Instead, Job puts it all on the line, and he announces that even if God were to take his very life, Job says, I will still put my trust and my faith in God. He's not alone. Peter's faith was just as resolved as Job's when the crowd started leaving Jesus. You love reading the story of Jesus where everything was such a high crescendo, and then all of a sudden the crowd started leaving. And Jesus, in one of those moments where the crowd was leaving, he turned to Peter, and Jesus says to Peter, do you want to leave too? And Peter looks at Jesus and says, Lord, to whom shall I go? You alone have the words of eternal life. Gang, when it comes down to it, faith is about trusting when things don't make sense. That's faith. Faith is about believing that something will happen even when it's not happening. Faith is about having hope in the midst of a hopeless situation. That's faith. Anything else other than that, well, that's just yielding to the evidence you see. Anything else is just agreeing with the facts. Anything else is consenting to reason. Our faith should be something that, like those two prophets, if the whole world witnessed us in the street, our faith should shock them. Yes. You want to be shocked? I spend my Saturday night in a field in White Township learning the Bible. Yeah. My faith should shock them. I give 1/10 of what I make to God. Shock them. Yes. I let God show me what is best for my children. I do what God tells me to do, no matter what the consequences. I do what God says. Yes. You want to be shocked? I love the unlovable. And yes, I've been ripped off. I've been taken advantage of. And I've been treated like dirt for loving people for God. Though he slay me, yet will I serve him. Faith says this: take me as deep as you want on this diving board, God. Take me as deep as you want. I will focus on the beautiful flight of high sailing into a perfect swan dive of victory, because my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Let me ask you, as the band comes back, and our worship leaders come back, do you feel like you might be in a slain condition tonight? Do you feel like maybe you're lying in the middle of that street, dead? You are a phoenix. God designed us to be phoenixes. It's time to rise. It's time to take faith that our kids will find God. It's time to take faith that God will provide for my needs. It's time to take faith. God does know better than you. It's time to take faith. What he asks me to do, I'm going to do it. If it hurts, if it costs me, if people make fun of me, I'm going to do it. Because I will rise like a phoenix. Because my God has the power over life and death. And he's promised to have my back. And this defeat, this is just a springboard to victory. Lord, I pray that you would help each of us as we try to live a Revelation 11 life, that you would help us to be faithful witnesses for you. And though they slay me, yet will I serve him. We know we will rise again. Teach us to rise like a phoenix.